I think we are.
Yeah. All right, so I'd like to introduce to you now Dr. Nathan Wiseman-Fels from the University of Northampton. Welcome. Please welcome Nathan.
Thank you very much for having me. It's kind of nice to get the first one done and then I can just sit back and watch the rest of you suffer for the next few days. Just before I start talking about this, a very, very quick plug for something me and some students have been working on at the University of Northampton. I'll be handing out some flyers about this later, but we're setting up an undergraduate popular music studies conference on the 30th of May at the University of Northampton. Free registration, please come along. And I should have put it on here, but the website is u-pop.org. So have a look for the U-pop conference. Sorry, just trying to get a few people to come. Fascinating paper from Hillegonda, and there are a couple of things. I was frantically sort of adding bits into my paper because I thought, well, that's really good. I like that. So I might steal some bits if that's all right. Really interested in shoegaze music, and I don't know what that means to most of you. I read a paper some years ago for a conference which was talking about a particular kind of sonic moment that seems to kind of commonly occur in shoegaze music, and I'll explain what I mean by that if you don't know the term, around sort of late 80s, early 90s. This kind of moment of extreme noise that structurally tends to replace guitar solos where you would expect them to be in conventional pop music. And I kind of thought I'd like to kind of revisit that idea a little bit and try and use it to explain something that I've kind of personally experienced myself. So I'm going to start off by giving you kind of three quick examples of the thing that I'm going to talk about. So back before I started doing my PhD and suddenly found I didn't have time for such things, I was in a couple of bands, and we would go into little rehearsal spaces and we'd be hammering away, and it would always kind of be, you would feel you were doing well if a particular kind of phenomenon occurred where everybody's really gelling together, you're powering away, it's wonderful, and you start to hear kind of sonic events that you can't quite attribute to any individual person in the room. And when I started thinking about this, I thought, this is just me. I'm kind of hearing these phantom sounds, but having talked to other people, you know, similar kinds of things seem to be occurring. This seems to be something which is an effect of, you know, a number of sonic voices occurring at the same space, often in a specific kind of physical space, and creating other sonic voices that are kind of rising, conjuring, you know, being summoned out of the midst. I now make music as Mantra Head on my own in my shed in my garden, and I've discovered actually there are similar kinds of things going on, where the overlaying of different sonic voices produces another kind of effect that you can't quite work out. A track that I did recently was sampling Noi and Patti Smith and my own guitar playing, and by the time you kind of stuck them together, there was this kind of really weird kind of slurring sort of thing going on that I couldn't attribute to any of the samples that I was using, but it seemed to be suddenly there without my intention, which I rather liked. And I was chatting to our technician down at the University of Northampton in the recording studio the other day, and he sort of talked about a very similar experience where he'd been constantly listening to a second year band who had been rehearsing material for a performance, and they kind of got to a point where they were really, really tight. They'd just go in, they'd do it, it would sound absolutely fantastic. And he was starting, because he heard this track so many times, was starting to hear other things kind of coming out of the mix. And I thought this was really interesting, and it seemed to kind of call to mind some of the things that I'd been talking about in relationship to shoegaze music. So I've called this Phantom Chords. So that's a bit of a pun on Dave Vanian's kind of post-Damned band, but this idea of phantom sounds I want to talk a little bit about. And I'm kind of using this metaphor of kind of conjuration, of summoning. For me, what seems to be happening is that in performance, not only from the musician's perspective, but also from the audience's perspective, there is another presence that can potentially kind of appear, and I've called this the dark other. there are a variety of different ways I want to kind of try and approach this theoretically. So I'm going to do a bit of a sort of smorgasbord of ways in which we might think about this. Primarily from a sort of Freudian, post-Freudian kind of approach, but then through to something which is perhaps a little bit more slippy in terms of Deleuze's idea of assemblages. So I don't know whether there's a conclusion to this or not. We shall see. Possibly not. So I'm kind of concentrating on shoegaze music, or what we might call dream pop, this kind of neo-psychedelic kind of alternative rock, but that covers a huge range of different things, from very kind of grungy sort of alt-rock through to very kind of blissed-out electronica. But my point is kind of applicable, I think, to most forms of music. So while I'm kind of talking about shoegaze, kind of be thinking about the sorts of music that you enjoy or that you're engaged with, because I think that there is something quite intrinsic about music, and this touches on something that Helgamta talked about. There's something very intrinsic about music making, which is about projecting yourself out to an alternate position. And the relationship to technology sort of has a role to play in that as well. And around all of this is this role of authorial intent. What I'm kind of noticing here really is that there are sounds appearing that I have no control over. There are sounds appearing, well, maybe I do, but not consciously. There are sounds that are perhaps seemingly authored by someone that I'm not aware of, which I might find threatening or uncanny in some kind of way. I want to start off with a clip. Whether you would specifically kind of call this band shoegazing or not, I don't know, but there's certainly there are similarities. This is a clip from a track called Whirring by a band called The Joy Formidable, who are a Welsh band. Absolutely fantastic and well worth listening to. This is a particular live version of Whirring, which comes from their first album, The Big Roar, and I'll come back to that phrase in a minute. I've had to edit it together because it's about 10 minutes long. So what you'll see here is a bit right from the beginning where it sort of seems like a conventional pop song, a little bit sort of from about halfway through where it's just sounding like a conventional pop song getting, you know, to a sort of a crescendo or a climax. And then there's this long extended period where particularly the bass player Ridian and the guitarist and singer Ritzy are abandoning their instruments and just making a hell of a lot of noise. So I shall play this. Oh,
making all that magnificent sound.
Now, I like effects pedals, so this band appeals to me greatly. And there is no greater joy than just putting your guitar up against the amp and twiddling knobs. And that's what's going on there, clearly. What seems to happen through the song is a trajectory, one in which you sort of start off with a relatively conventional kind of song structure and sound. By the time the band are really, really getting into it, and this is kind of represented on the album as well in recorded form to some extent, the band kind of seem to be releasing control over what they're doing to an extent. So they're getting more and more into it. They're hitting the guitars instead of playing them. They're taking the guitars off up against the amps. And then it's just, I don't know whether we quite say they're randomly twiddling knobs, but they're clearly sort of creating a certain element of randomness or chance through the manipulation of the pedals and the instruments. And clearly there's kind of a sort of affinity with aleatoric or experimental music and the idea of creating a process that allows music to happen that you have no ultimate control over what it sounds like. But that loss of control really interests me. I left the credits at the end because of the comment that Cheryl Waters, the host, says, you know, for those of you listening at home, it's only three people making that noise. And I would say, well, perhaps no, it isn't. So this idea of phantom sound interests me. Pedals, the way in which they affect the signal of the guitar, are allowing other things to happen. You mentioned about the sound of the echo and the signal having disappeared. I bought myself a Super Ego, Electro-Harmonic Super Ego pedal a couple of months ago. It's my new favourite toy. And I just recorded myself playing guitar. I'm playing, I'm doing things, I'm deciding which notes, more or less, that you know I want to play. The pedal is then kind of picking up certain elements of the sound and creating harmonics, frozen harmonics that will just kind of keep going. I sort of stopped playing and just let it carry on for about 2 minutes at the end of the track, and it's that kind of sense of another presence, whether it's a technological one or whether it's me in a way that I don't quite fully comprehend, that I think is kind of at the heart of what's happening with the Joy Formidables thing and with shoegazing, as I'll mention in a minute. This kind of sound coming out of ensemble performance might be understood as us imposing some kind of order upon the chaos of sound that we can kind of hear. And I kind of thought, well, it's very similar to sort of maybe one of the explanations of EVP, electronic voice phenomena, the voices that you hear, the sort of spectral ghost voices that you hear in static or white noise. And I'm by no means a sound engineer, but equally the idea of intermodulation, the way in which kind of different frequencies are clashing and amplifying certain kinds of sounds, seems perhaps to explain this. Clearly we want to try and impose patterns upon sonic chaos, but what this might actually do is kind of create a sort of spectral other that we can't quite understand. And that spectral other means that there is a sort of extra subjective experience going on. You know, you're kind of presupposing that someone else, even if they don't exist, must be creating that sound in some strange way. So from this I kind of thought, well, if we're making music, the assumption usually is that there is an author to make that music. And therefore, if we're hearing other music that we can't attribute to an author, then we must be unconsciously presupposing another form of external subjectivity, which is what I'm sort of tenuously calling the dark other. Let me play you another very quick clip. This is, hopefully most of you know My Bloody Valentine, one of the most kind of key bands in kind of influencing the development of shoegaze. This is a track called You Made Me Realise. I'll play the clip. This is a bit right from the middle, and it's a piece that's commonly known as the Holocaust amongst MBV fans. have there, you made me realise, is a relatively conventional song structurally. Just at the point where you would imagine there would be a guitar solo or a bridge of some description, instead what you get is this noise. And this was something that you see in other similar kinds of shoegazing bands that I'll talk about in a second. And it was this Holocaust section that I was kind of interested in when I first started thinking about this. I saw My Bloody Valentine back in about 91 or 92 at the Town and Country Club, now the Kentish Town Forum. And that little minute or so of noise is extrapolated live, I think probably for about 15 minutes when I saw them. When they kind of came back to do some more gigs from around 2008, this was being stretched out for 20, 25 minutes. I believe there's a paper on the Cardiacs, which is coming up. Tim Smith from the Cardiacs sadly suffered a heart attack and stroke after seeing My Bloody Valentine at the Roundhouse. I don't know whether the two things are connected. But my experience of standing at the front with My Bloody Valentine being astonishingly loud, doing this Holocaust section, was initially, Jesus God, this is horrible. And I liked noisy stuff, but this is just really, really loud and just oppressive. And after about 5 minutes, actually, this is really peaceful. This is really... And I kind of completely lost sort of sense of time to an extent. I sort of slightly lost a sense of where I was. Strobe lights are flashing, dry ice, all that sort of disorientating stuff is going on. I started to hear other things, other voices that I couldn't quite identify within that sound, within this wall of sound. Just in preparing for this, it reminded me of a psychology experiment that I did. We have a parapsychology department at the University of Northampton, and they wanted to do a test of telepathy, which I failed, I hasten to add, but in having to do that, I had to sit in a darkened room with ping pong balls over my eyes and white noise going in my ears. And I started to visually hallucinate after about 20 minutes of this. Strangely, a huge plastic dinosaur sitting on a hill. I don't know what that says about me. And I started to experience these kind of auditory hallucinations within the white noise as well. And I kind of thought, that's exactly the same experience that I had with My Bloody Valentine. My Bloody Valentine are kind of like an important sort of source along primarily in the UK with Cocteau Twins and Jesus and Mary Chain, in what comes to be known as shoegaze, or the scene that celebrates itself, or dream pop. And there's a kind of, over the last 10 years, perhaps even longer, there's been a resurgent new gaze movement that's kind of come out of primarily America and Europe. I hate people who reference themselves, but not many people have written on this. But Ben Halligan's done some interesting work. Simon Reynolds and Joy Press before that. My phone's going off. Why does my phone go off when I'm actually talking to everybody? It's the dark other calling me. What a lot of people have sort of tended to sort of say about shoegaze is they've kind of focused on the timbral qualities of it and this kind of blissed out, rapturous kind of sublimation to sound, which I have yet to kind of particularly disagree with. You have a kind of early stage of shoegaze bands, sort of bands like Slowdive. We have Neil Halstead playing tonight, and I saw Slowdive back at the Kentish Forum back in December. Oddly, they don't sort of do this kind of big, noisy thing quite so much. But bands like Lush, who do Levitation, who are not quite a shoegaze band, but they have a track called Bedlam that sort of does similar sorts of things. And more contemporary bands like M83, Ringo, Death Star, Sample, Melody's Echo Chamber, Washed Out, and various others. There's a kind of a tendency to approach this from a psychoanalytic point of view, which is about an engagement with noise in a gendered way. Simon Reynolds, talking about the band Loop, says, listening to Loop you feel wombed, which is one of my favourite quotes. But there's a sense in which the sound, the intensity of the sound, is in some way kind of enveloping you kind of threatening your subjectivity in an attractive kind of way, but one that's also slightly threatening. For my money, I've tended to kind of gravitate towards using Julia Kristeva's semiotic and symbolic ways of thinking about this, of the structure of the pop song as being a symbolic representation, the timbral noise being a sort of semiotic threat to that structure. And what you see at the end of Whirring and what you hear in the middle of You Made Me Realise is the collapse of that symbolic structure. It's like the intensity gets too much for the musicians to be able to play it And so they just hit things and make noise. And it's kind of a very id-like expression of the desire to articulate something without a structure to give it shape. Now, in thinking about this dark other, as soon as I came up with that phrase, I suddenly started thinking about Carl Jung and his idea of the shadow. And I started sort of also thinking about the kind of common visual hallucination of waking up in the middle of the night and seeing a shadowy figure standing in your bedroom, which is meant to be a kind of common sort of thing. I'm not going to suggest that really happens. But there does seem to be something uncanny about this phantom sound appearing. Freud talks, bouncing off of his colleague Otto Rank in 1919 in his very famous article, The Uncanny. He talks about things we find uncanny are uncanny because we both find them foreign and we recognise them. And he uses the term unheimlich to explain unheimlich being kind of unfamiliar or unhomely. The things that we find disturbing are things that our subconscious sort of recognises, but that we're not kind of consciously aware of. So, for example, doppelgangers or doubles or twins. The imaginary friend we have as a child is an insurance. It's kind of like a backing up of yourself against the possibility of death at a time where you have a very tenuous relationship to subjectivity as a young child. As you get older and suddenly, you know, you're watching The Shining and there are the two girls standing in the corridor, come and play with us. Suddenly we find that uncanny because it calls us back to that moment where our sense of selfhood and subjectivity is tenuous and difficult to kind of hang on to. So that kind of might explain why we find it odd that we suddenly hear these phantom sounds. Jung's concept of the shadow is useful here as well. The shadow is a kind of projection of the unconscious, the things that we're not consciously aware of in ourselves. And in the process of individuation, this kind of coming to sort of a sense of completeness, psychological completeness that Jung talks about, the shadow has to be kind of embraced and engaged with. I've talked a little bit about kind of Christeva's kind of post-Freudian sort of approach to representation that might also sort of explain some of this too. Sorry if I'm going through this a bit quick, I'm aware of the time. But that sort of seemed very deterministic to me. And I felt like there was something a little bit more radical going on. So in times like this, you turn to Deleuze, I find. if in doubt, because he'll explain everything. What did seem to be happening was that there seemed to be quite a nice example of his concept of assemblages. So I'm in a rehearsal room with four other people and we're playing, and the music itself might be understood as an assemblage of all of our individual contributions. But then there are these other voices that are appearing within that soundscape that none of us are kind of directly responsible for. So what seems to be happening is that there is a sort of field of dynamic interactions, as I start reading, just to make sure I say the important things, that are producing effects that are in a constant state of becoming, and they're also producing a sort of other subjectivity, which is both threatening and scary, but also attractive in some way. You also mentioned about cyborgs, and I thought the technology does play a role in this as well as a sort of intermediary process. Even if you're talking about guitars and amplifiers and what have you, you're still engaging with a technology that is in some way othering your intention. This big roar, this noise, this kind of ensemble sound that the Joy Formidable are kind of perhaps doing at the end of Whirring, the Holocaust section of You Made Me Realise, note that both of those terms seem to imply threat, you know, the big roar, the lion, the carnivore, and also the horror of the Holocaust. And the phantom sounds manifesting themselves in performance are literally sonic assemblages, effects of interaction and becoming as the music develops in imminent and instantaneous ways. By exceeding in terms of sonic overload, the musician's capacity to control the sound that they make, or in exceeding the psychic boundaries of the self, shoegaze and dream pop perhaps offer both the promise and the threat of annihilation. as the character of the sounds experienced both envelop us as musicians and as audience members, and offer up a shadow self that we don't recognise as us or coming from us, problematising the limits of our subjectivity. The pop space, the pop sound, usually is structured, usually has some sense of an author who intends it to sound that way. And the excessive overload of noise here is troubling that idea. Authorship, composition and intention mark out much popular music practice, yet this seems to throw a pebble into the middle of the pond and ruin that. Yet this engagement with noise, the phantom sounds, becoming in the midst of performance, the fragmenting and swamping of subjectivity momentarily deterritorializes that pop space. It's the recognition of sound outside of ourselves and our own unconscious attempts to make sense of those sounds that shows a de- and then a re-territorialization of the sonic experience and ultimately our own sense of selfhood. By summoning up the dark other, sound occupies two positions instantaneously, as a disturber of the symbolic order and as a new unbidden manifestation of that same order as experienced through the mind of the musician or the audience member. To be both inside and outside, to be chaotic yet ordered, is enough of a paradox to account for noise pops, joyous abstraction and malevolent sonic presence. Thank you very much.